back right away, which can then be used to make new loans. However, if you take the word responsibly out of that sentence, it does become a bad thing. Simon Johnson, former chief economist for the International Monetary Fund, wrote an excellent post-mortem of the financial crisis for The Atlantic in 2009. He notes, "Major commercial and investment banks, and the hedge funds that ran alongside them, were the big beneficiaries of the twin housing and equity market bubbles of this decade. Their profits, fed by an ever-increasing volume of transactions founded on a relatively small base of actual physical assets. Each time a loan was sold, packaged, securitized, and resold, banks took their transaction fees, and the hedge funds buying those securities reaped ever larger fees as their holdings grew. Each transaction carries some embedded risk. The problem is that the bankers making huge commissions on the buying and selling of what would later become known as toxic assets do not bear the full risk of those products. Their firms do. Heads they win, tails the firm loses. In the case of Lehman Brothers, that's a pretty accurate description of what happened. Yes, the Lehman employees lost their jobs, but those most responsible for the collapse of the firm don't have to give back the huge bonuses they made in the good years. One other culpable party deserves mention, and again, misaligned incentives was a key problem. The credit rating agencies, Standard & Poor's, Moody's, and others, are supposed to be the independent authorities that evaluate the risk of these newfangled products. Many of the toxic assets now at the heart of the financial meltdown were given stellar credit ratings. Part of this was pure incompetence. It didn't help, however, that the credit rating agencies are paid by the firms selling the bonds or securities being rated. That's a little like a used car salesman paying an appraiser to stand around the lot and provide helpful advice to customers. "Hey, Bob, why don't you come on over here and tell the customer whether he's getting a good deal or not?" How useful do you think that would be? These corporate incentive problems remain unresolved as far as I can tell, both for senior executives in public companies and for other employees taking risks with their firm's capital. There's a fundamental tension that's tough to resolve. On the one hand, firms need to reward innovation, risk, insight, hard work, and so on. These are good things for the firm, and employees who do them well should be paid handsomely, even astronomically in some cases. On the other hand, the employees doing fancy things, like designing new financial products, will always have more information about what they're really up to than their superiors will. And their superiors will have more information than the shareholders. The challenge is to reward good outcomes without creating incentives for employees to game the system in ways that damage the company in the long run. One need not be a corporate titan to deal with principal agent problems. There are plenty of situations in which we must hire someone whose incentives are similar but not identical to our own. And the distinction between similar and identical can make all the difference. Take real estate agents, a particular breed of scoundrel who purport to have your best interests at stake but may not, regardless of whether you're buying or selling a property. Let's look at the buy side first. The agent graciously shows you lots of houses, and eventually you find one that's just right. So far, so good. Now it's time to bargain with the seller over the purchase price, often with your agent as your chief advisor. Yet, your real estate agent will be paid a percentage of the eventual purchase price. The more you're willing to pay, the more your agent makes, and the less time the whole process will take. There are problems on the sell side, too, though they're more subtle. The better price you get for your house, the more money your agent will make. That's a good thing. But the incentives are still not perfectly aligned. Suppose you're selling a house in the $300,000 range. Your agent can list the house for $280,000 and sell it in about 20 minutes. Or she could list it for $320,000 and wait for a buyer who really loves the place. The benefit to you of pricing the house high is huge, $40,000. Your real estate agent may see things differently. Listing high would mean many weeks of showing the house, holding open houses, and baking cookies to make the place smell good. Lots of work, in other words. Assuming a 3% commission, your agent can make $8,400 for doing virtually nothing, or $9,600 for doing many weeks of work. Which would you choose? On the buy side or the sell side, your agent's most powerful incentive is to get a deal done, whether it's at a price favorable to you or not. Economics teaches us how to get the incentives right. As Gordon Gekko told us in the movie Wall Street, greed is good, so make sure that you have it working on your side. Yet Mr. Gekko was not entirely correct. Greed can be bad, even for people who are entirely selfish. Indeed, some of the most interesting problems in economics involve situations in which rational individuals acting in their own best interest do things that make themselves worse off, yet their behavior is entirely logical. The classic example is the prisoner's dilemma, a somewhat contrived but highly powerful model of human behavior. The basic idea is that two men have been arrested on suspicion of murder. They're immediately separated so that they can be interrogated without communicating with one another. The case against them is not terribly strong, and the police are looking for a confession. Indeed, the authorities are willing to offer a deal if one of the men rats out the other as the trigger man. If neither man confesses, the police will charge them both with illegal possession of a weapon, which carries a 5-year jail sentence. If both of them confess, then each will receive a 25-year murder sentence. If one man rats out the other, then the snitch will receive a light 3-year sentence as an accomplice, and his partner will get life in prison. What happens? The men are best off collectively if they keep their mouths shut. But that's not what they do. Each of them starts thinking. Prisoner A figures that if his partner keeps his mouth shut, then he can get the light 3-year sentence by ratting him out. Then it dawns on him. His partner is almost certainly thinking the same thing, in which case he'd better confess to avoid having the whole crime pinned on himself. Indeed, his best strategy is to confess regardless of what his partner does. It either gets him the 3-year sentence, if his partner stays quiet, or saves him from getting life in prison, if his partner talks. Of course, prisoner B has the same incentives. They both confess, and they both get 25 years in prison, when they might have served only 5. Yet neither prisoner has done anything irrational. The amazing thing about this model is that it offers great insight into real-world situations in which unfettered self-interest leads to poor outcomes. It's particularly applicable to the way in which renewable natural resources, such as fisheries, are exploited when many individuals are drawing from a common resource. For example, if Atlantic swordfish are harvested wisely, such as by limiting the number of fish caught each season, then the swordfish population will remain stable or even grow, providing a living for fishermen indefinitely. But no one owns the world's swordfish stocks, making it difficult to police who catches what. As a result, independent fishing boats start to act a lot like our prisoners under interrogation. They can either limit their catch in the name of conservation, or they can take as many fish as possible. What happens? Exactly what the prisoner's dilemma predicts. The fishermen do not trust each other well enough to coordinate an outcome that would make them all better off. Rhode Island fisherman John Sorlene told the New York Times in a story on dwindling fish stocks, "Right now, my only incentive is to go out and kill as many fish as I can. I have no incentive to conserve the fishery, because any fish I leave is just going to be picked up by the next guy." So the world stocks of tuna, cod, swordfish, and lobster are fished away. Meanwhile, Politicians often make the situation worse by bailing out struggling fishermen with assorted subsidies. This merely keeps boats in the water when some fishermen might otherwise quit. Sometimes individuals need to be saved from themselves. One nice example of this is the lobstering community of Port Lincoln on Australia's southern coast. In the 1960s, the community set a limit on the number of traps that could be set and then sold licenses for those traps. Since then, any newcomer could enter the business only by buying a license from another lobsterman. This limit on the overall catch has allowed the lobster population to thrive. Ironically, Port Lincoln lobstermen catch more than their American colleagues while working less. Meanwhile, a license purchased in 1984 for $2,000 now fetches about $35,000. As Aussie lobsterman Darrell Spencer told the Times, "Why hurt the fishery? It's my retirement fund. No one's going to pay me $35,000 a pot if there are no lobsters left. If I rape and pillage the fishery now, in 10 years, my licenses won't be worth anything." Mr. Spencer is not smarter or more altruistic than his fishing colleagues around the world. He just has different incentives. Oddly, some environmental groups oppose these kinds of licensed quotas because they privatize a public resource. They also fear that the licenses will be bought up by large corporations, driving small fishermen out of business. So far, the evidence strongly suggests that creating private property rights, giving individual fishermen the right to a certain catch, including the option of selling that right, is the most effective tool in the face of collapsing commercial fisheries. A 2008 study of the world's commercial fisheries published in Science found that individual transferable quotas can stop or even reverse the collapse of fishing stocks. Fisheries managed with transferable quotas were half as likely to collapse as fisheries that use traditional methods. Two other points regarding incentives are worth noting. First, a market economy inspires hard work and progress not just because it rewards winners, but because it crushes losers. The 1990s were a great time to be involved in the Internet. They were bad years to be in the electric typewriter business. Implicit in Adam Smith's Invisible Hand is the idea of creative destruction, a term coined by the Austrian economist Joseph Schumpeter. Markets do not suffer fools gladly. Take Walmart, a remarkably efficient retailer that often leaves carnage in its wake. Americans flock to Walmart because the store offers an amazing range of products cheaper than they can be purchased anywhere else. This is a good thing. Being able to buy goods cheaper is essentially the same thing as having more income. At the same time, Walmart is the ultimate nightmare for Al's Glass and Hardware in Pekin, Illinois, and for mom-and-pop shops everywhere else. The pattern is well established. Walmart opens a giant store just outside of town. Several years later, the small shops on Main Street are closed and boarded up. Capitalism can be a brutal, cruel process. We look back and speak admiringly of technological breakthroughs like the steam engine, the spinning wheel, and the telephone. But those advances made it a bad time to be, respectively, a blacksmith, a seamstress, or a telegraph operator. Creative destruction is not just something that might happen in a market economy. It is something that must happen. At the beginning of the 20th century, half of all Americans worked in farming or ranching. Now that figure is about 1 in 100 and still falling. Iowa is still losing roughly 1,500 farmers a year. Note that two important things have not happened. 1, we have not starved to death, and 2, we do not have a 49% unemployment rate. Instead, American farmers have become so productive that we need far fewer of them to feed ourselves. The individuals who would have been farming 90 years ago are now fixing our cars, designing computer games, playing professional football, etc. Just imagine our collective loss of utility if Steve Jobs, Steven Spielberg, and Oprah Winfrey were corn farmers. Creative destruction is a tremendous positive force in the long run. The bad news is that people don't pay their bills in the long run. The folks at the mortgage company can be real sticklers about getting that check every month. When a plant closes or an industry is wiped out by competition, it can be years or even an entire generation before the affected workers and communities recover. Anyone who has ever driven through New England has seen the abandoned or underutilized mills that are monuments to the days when America still manufactured things like textiles and shoes. Or one can drive through Gary, Indiana, where miles of rusting steel plants are a reminder that the city was not always most famous for having more murders per capita than any other city in the United States. Competition means losers, which goes a long way toward explaining why we embrace it heartily, in theory, and then often fight it bitterly, in practice. A college classmate of mine worked for a congressman from Michigan shortly after our graduation. My friend was not allowed to drive his Japanese car to work, lest it be spotted in one of the Michigan congressman's reserved parking spaces. That congressman will almost certainly tell you that he is a capitalist. Of course he believes in markets, unless a Japanese company happens to make a better, cheaper car, in which case the staff member who bought that vehicle should be forced to take the train to work. I would argue that the American automakers would have been much stronger in the long run if they had faced this international competition head-on, instead of looking for political protection from the first wave of Japanese imports in the 1970s and 1980s. This is nothing new. Competition is always best when it involves other people. During the Industrial Revolution, weavers in rural England demonstrated, petitioned Parliament, and even burned down textile mills in an effort to fend off mechanization. Would we be better off now if they had succeeded and we still made all of our clothes by hand? If you make a better mousetrap, the world will beat a path to your door. If you make the old mousetrap, it's time to start firing people. This helps to explain our ambivalence to international trade and globalization, to ruthless retailers like Walmart, and even to some kinds of technology and automation. Competition also creates some interesting policy trade-offs. Government inevitably faces pressure to help firms and industries under siege from competition and to protect the affected workers. Yet many of the things that minimize the pain inflicted by competition, bailing out firms or making it hard to lay off workers, slow down or stop the process of creative destruction. To quote my junior high school football coach, no pain, no gain. One other matter related to incentives vastly complicates public policy. It is not easy to transfer money from the rich to the poor. Congress can pass the laws, but wealthy taxpayers do not stand idly by. They change their behavior in ways that avoid as much taxation as possible, moving money around, making investments that shelter income, or, in extreme cases, moving to another jurisdiction. When Bjorn Borg dominated the tennis world during my childhood, the Swedish government taxed his earnings at an extremely high rate. Borg did not lobby the Swedish government for lower taxes or write passionate op-eds about the role of taxes in the economy. He merely transferred his residence to Monaco, where the tax burden is much lower. At least he was still playing tennis. Taxes provide a powerful incentive to avoid or reduce the activity that is taxed. In America, where much of our revenue comes from the income tax, high taxes discourage income. Will people really stop or start working based on tax rates? Yes. Especially when the worker involved is the family's second earner. Virginia Pastrell, a columnist on economics for the New York Times, has declared that tax rates are a feminist issue. Because of the marriage tax, second earners in families with high household incomes who are more likely to be women pay an average of 50 cents in taxes for every dollar they earn, which profoundly affects the decision to work or stay home. By disproportionately punishing married women's work, the tax system distorts women's personal choices. And by discouraging valuable work, it lowers our overall standard of living, she writes. She offers some interesting evidence. As a result of the 1986 tax reform, marginal tax rates for women in the highest income brackets fell more sharply than tax rates for women with lower incomes, meaning that they saw a much sharper drop in the amount that the government takes from every paycheck. Did they respond differently from women who did not get the same large tax break? Yes. Their participation in the workforce jumped 3 times as much. On the corporate side, high taxes can have a similar effect. High taxes lower a firm's return on investment, thereby providing less incentive to invest in plants, research, and other activities that lead to economic growth. Once again, we're faced with an unpleasant trade-off. Raising taxes to provide generous benefits to disadvantaged Americans can simultaneously discourage the kinds of productive investments that might make them better off. If tax rates get high enough, individuals and firms may slip into the underground economy, where they opt to break the law and avoid taxes entirely. Scandinavian countries, which offer generous government programs funded by high marginal tax rates, have seen large growth in the size of their black market economies. Experts estimate that the underground economy in Norway grew from 1.5% of gross national product in 1960 to 18% by the mid-1990s. Cheating the tax man can be a vicious circle. As more individuals and firms slip into the underground economy, tax rates must go up for everyone else in order to provide the same level of government revenue. Higher taxes, in turn, cause more flight to the underground economy, and so on. The challenge of transferring money from rich to poor is not just on the taxation side. Government benefits create perverse incentives, too. Generous unemployment benefits diminish the incentive to find work. Welfare policy, prior to reform in 1996, offered cash payments only to unemployed single women with children, which implicitly punished poor women who were married or employed, two things that the government generally does not try to discourage. This is not to suggest that all government benefits go to poor people. They don't. The largest federal entitlement programs are Social Security and Medicare, which go to all Americans, even the very rich. By providing guaranteed benefits in old age, both programs may discourage personal savings. Indeed, this is the subject of a long simmering debate. Some economists argue that government old age benefits cause us to save less, thereby lowering the national savings rate, because we need to set aside less money for retirement. Others argue that Social Security and Medicare do not reduce our personal savings. They merely allow us to pass along more money to our children and grandchildren. Empirical studies have not found a clear answer one way or the other. This is not merely an esoteric squabble among academics. As we shall explore later in the book, a low savings rate can limit the pool of capital available to make the kinds of investments that allow us to improve our standard of living. None of this should be interpreted as a blanket argument against taxes or government programs. Rather, economists spend much more time than politicians thinking about what kind of taxes we should collect and how we should structure government benefits. For example, both a gasoline tax and an income tax generate revenue. Yet, they create profoundly different incentives. The income tax will discourage some people from working, which is a bad thing. The gasoline tax will discourage some people from driving, which can be a good thing. Indeed, green taxes collect revenue by taxing activities that are detrimental to the environment, and sin taxes do the same thing for the likes of cigarettes, alcohol, and gambling. In general, economists tend to favor taxes that are broad, simple, and fair. A simple tax is easily understood and collected. A fair tax implies only that two similar individuals, such as two people with the same income, will pay similar taxes. A broad tax means that revenue is raised by imposing a small tax on a very large group, rather than imposing a large tax on a very small group. A broad tax is harder to evade because fewer activities are exempted. And since the tax rate is lower, there is less incentive to evade it anyway. We should not, for example, impose a large tax on the sale of red sports cars. The tax could be avoided, easily and legally, by buying another color, in which case everybody is made worse off. The government collects no revenue, and sports car enthusiasts do not get to drive their favorite color car. This phenomenon, whereby taxes make individuals worse off without making anyone else better off, is referred to as deadweight loss. It would be preferable to tax all sports cars, or even all cars, because more revenue could be raised with a much smaller tax. Then again, a gasoline tax collects revenue from drivers, just as a tax on new cars does, but it also provides an incentive to conserve fuel. Those who drive more pay more. So now, we're raising a great deal of revenue with a tiny tax and doing a little something for the environment, too. Many economists would go yet one step further. We should tax the use of all kinds of carbon-based fuels, such as coal, oil, and gasoline. Such a tax would raise revenue from a broad base while creating an incentive to conserve non-renewable resources and curtail the CO2 emissions that cause global warming. Sadly, this thought process does not lead us to the optimal tax. We've merely swapped one problem for another. A tax on red sports cars would be paid only by the rich. A carbon tax would be paid by rich and poor alike. But it would probably cost the poor a larger fraction of their income. Taxes that fall more heavily on the poor than the rich, so-called regressive taxes, often offend our sense of justice. Progressive taxes, such as the income tax, fall more heavily on the rich than the poor. Here, as elsewhere, economics does not give us a right answer, only an analytical framework for thinking about important questions. Indeed, the most efficient tax of all, one that is perfectly broad, simple, and fair, in the narrow tax-related sense of the word, is a lump-sum tax, which is imposed uniformly on every individual in a jurisdiction. Former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher actually tried it in 1989 with the community charge, or poll tax. What happened? Britons rioted in the streets at the prospect of every adult paying the same tax for local community services, regardless of income or property wealth, though there were some reductions for students, the poor, and the unemployed. Obviously, good economics is not always good politics. Meanwhile, not all benefits are created equal either. One of the biggest poverty-fighting tools in recent years has been the Earned Income Tax Credit, or EITC. An idea that economists have pushed for decades because it creates a far better set of incentives than traditional social welfare programs. Most social programs offer benefits to individuals who are not working. The EITC does just the opposite. It uses the income tax system to subsidize low-wage workers so that their total income is raised above the poverty line. A worker who earns $11,000 and is supporting a family of four might get an additional $8,000 through the EITC and matching state programs. The idea was to make work pay. Indeed, the system provides a powerful incentive for individuals to get into the labor force, where it's hoped they can learn skills and advance to higher-paying jobs. Of course, the program has an obvious problem, too. Unlike welfare, the EITC does not help individuals who cannot find work at all. In reality, those are the folks who are likely to be most desperate. When I applied to graduate school many years ago, I wrote an essay expressing my puzzlement at how a country that could put a man on the moon could still have people sleeping on the streets. Part of that problem is political will. We could take a lot of people off the streets tomorrow if we made it a national priority. But I've also come to realize that NASA had it easy. Rockets conform to the unchanging laws of physics. We know where the moon will be at a given time. We know precisely how fast a spacecraft will enter or exit the Earth's orbit. If we get the equations right, the rocket will land where it's supposed to, always. Human beings are more complex than that. A recovering drug addict does not behave as predictably as a rocket in orbit. We don't have a formula for persuading a 16-year-old not to drop out of school. But we do have a powerful tool. We know that people seek to make themselves better off, however they may define that. Our best hope for improving the human condition is to understand why we act the way we do and then plan accordingly. Programs, organizations, and systems work better when they get the incentives right. It's like rowing downstream. Chapter 3. Government and the Economy. Government is your friend. And a round of applause for all those lawyers. The first car I ever owned was a Honda Civic. I loved the car, but I sold it with a lot of good miles left in it. Why? Two reasons. One, it didn't have a cup holder, and two, my wife was pregnant, and I'd become fearful that our whole family would get flattened by a Chevy Suburban. I could have gotten beyond the cup holder problem, but putting a car seat in a vehicle that weighed a quarter as much as the average SUV was not an option. So we bought a Ford Explorer and became part of the problem for all of those people still driving Honda Civics. When our Ford Explorer rolled over at 65 miles per hour on an interstate 3 years later, we bought a Volvo. The point is this. My decision to buy and drive an SUV affects everyone else on the road, yet none of those people has a say in my decision. I do not have to compensate all the owners of Honda Civics for the fact that I'm putting their lives slightly more at risk. Nor do I have to compensate asthmatic children who'll be made worse off by the exhaust I generate as I cruise around the city getting 9 miles to the gallon. And I have never mailed off a check to people living on small Pacific islands who may someday find their entire countries underwater because my CO2 emissions are melting the polar ice caps. Yet, these are real costs associated with driving a less fuel-efficient car. My decision to buy a Ford Explorer causes what economists refer to as an externality, which means that the private costs of my behavior are different from the social costs. When my wife and I went to the Burt Wineman Ford dealership and the salesman Angel asked, "What is it going to take for me to put you in this car?" We tallied up the costs of driving an Explorer rather than a Civic. More gas, more expensive insurance, higher car payments. There was nothing on our tally sheet about asthmatic children, melting polar ice caps, or pregnant women driving Mini Coopers. Are these costs associated with driving an Explorer? Yes. Do we have to pay them? No. Therefore, they did not figure into our decision, other than as a vague sense of guilt as we contemplated telling our environmentally conscious relatives who live in Boulder, Colorado, and flush the toilet only once a day in order to conserve water. When an externality, the gap between the private cost and the social cost of some behavior, is large, individuals have an incentive to do things that make them better off at the expense of others. The market, left alone, will do nothing to fix this problem. In fact, the market fails, in the sense that it encourages individuals and firms to cut corners in ways that make society worse off as a result. If this concept were really as dry as most economics textbooks make it seem, then a movie like Michael Clayton would not have made millions at the box office. After all, that film is about a simple externality. A large agribusiness company stands accused of producing a pesticide that is seeping into local water supplies and poisoning families. There is no market solution in this case. The market is the problem. The polluting company maximizes profits by selling a product that causes cancer in innocent victims. Farmers who are unaware of or indifferent to the pollution will actually reward the company by buying more of its product, which will be cheaper or more effective than what can be produced by competitors that invest in making their products non-toxic. The only redress in this film example, like Aaron Brockovich and A Civil Action before it, was through a non-market, government-supported mechanism, the courts. And of course, George Clooney looks good making sure justice is done, as Julia Roberts and John Travolta did before him. Consider a more banal example, but one that raises the ire of most city dwellers. People who don't pick up after their dogs. In a perfect world, we'd all carry pooper scoopers because we derive utility from behaving responsibly. But we don't live in a perfect world. From the narrow perspective of some individual dog walkers, it's easier, less costly, in economists speak, to ignore Fido's unsightly pile and walk blithely on. For those who think this is a trivial example, an average of 650 people a year break bones or are hospitalized in Paris after slipping in dog waste, according to the New York Times. The pooper scooper decision can be modeled like any other economic decision. A dog owner weighs the costs and benefits of behaving responsibly and then scoops or does not scoop. But who speaks for the woman running to catch the bus the next morning who makes one misstep and is suddenly having a very bad day? No one. Which is why most cities have laws requiring pet owners to pick up after their animals. Thankfully, there's a broader point. One crucial role for government in a market economy is dealing with externalities. Those cases in which individuals or firms engage in private behavior that has broader social consequences. I noted in Chapter 1 that all market transactions are voluntary exchanges that make the involved parties better off. That's still true. But note the word involved that has left me some wiggle room. The problem is that all of the individuals affected by a market transaction may not be sitting at the table when the deal is struck. My former neighbor Stuart, with whom we shared an adjoining wall, was an avid bongo drum player. I'm sure that both he and the music shop owner were both pleased when he purchased a new set of bongos. Based on the noise involved, he may even have purchased some kind of high-tech amplifier. But I was not happy about that transaction. Externalities are at the root of all kinds of policy issues, from the mundane to those that literally threaten the planet. The Economist has suggested somewhat peevishly that families traveling with small children on airplanes should be required to fly at the back of the plane so that other passengers might enjoy a child-free zone. An editorial in the magazine noted, "Children, just like cigarettes or mobile phones, clearly impose a negative externality on people who are near them. Anybody who has suffered a 12-hour flight with a bawling baby in the row immediately ahead or a bored youngster viciously kicking their seat from behind will grasp this as quickly as they would love to grasp the youngster's neck. Here is a clear case of market failure. Parents do not bear the full costs. Indeed, young babies travel free. So they are too ready to take their noisy brats with them. Where is the invisible hand when it is needed to administer a good smack? Mobile phone use is under stricter scrutiny, both in public places, such as restaurants and commuter trains, where the behavior is fabulously annoying, but also in vehicles, where it's been linked to a higher rate of accidents. Texting is the second most dangerous thing you can do while driving a car, next to driving drunk. In Chicago, Mayor Richard Daley attempted to impose a 1 cent tax on every $2 of takeout food purchases, arguing that the litter tax would reimburse the city for the cost of picking up litter, much of which consists of discarded fast food containers. The mayor's economics were sound. Litter is a classic externality. But a judge ruled the ordinance unconstitutional because it was vague and lacking in uniformity in the way it dealt with different kinds of fast food containers. Now there's talk at the federal level of a junk food tax or a soda tax to deal with a different kind of food-related externality, obesity. The health care costs associated with obesity are now roughly as high as those related to smoking. Society picks up at least some of the tab for those bills through the costs of government health programs and higher insurance premiums, giving me a reason to care whether you have a Big Mac for lunch or not. Global warming is one of the most difficult international challenges, in large part because firms that emit large amounts of greenhouse gases pay only a small share of the cost of those emissions. Indeed, even the countries in which they reside do not bear the full cost of the pollution. A steel plant in Pennsylvania emits CO2 that may one day cause a flood in Bangladesh. Meanwhile, acid rain caused by U.S. emissions is already killing Canadian forests. The same thing is true in all kinds of factories around the world. Any solution to global warming will have to raise the cost of emitting greenhouse gases in a way that's binding upon all of the Earth's polluters. Not the easiest of tasks. It's worth noting that there can be positive externalities as well. An individual's behavior can have a positive impact on society for which he or she is not fully compensated. I once had an office window that looked out across the Chicago River at the Wrigley Building and the Tribune Tower, two of the most beautiful buildings in the city renowned for its architecture. On a clear day, the view of the skyline and of these two buildings in particular was positively inspiring. But I spent 5 years in that office without paying for the utility that I derived from this wonderful architecture. I didn't mail a check to the Tribune Company every time I glanced out the window. Or, in the realm of economic development, a business may invest in a downtrodden neighborhood in a way that attracts other kinds of investment. Yet this business is not compensated for anchoring what may become an economic revitalization, which is why local governments often offer subsidies for such investment. Some activities have both positive and negative externalities. Cigarettes kill people who smoke them. That is old news. Responsible adults are free to smoke or not smoke as they choose. But cigarette smoke can also harm those who happen to be lingering nearby, which is why most office buildings consider smoking to be slightly less acceptable than running through the halls naked. Meanwhile, all 50 states filed suit against the tobacco industry and subsequently accepted large settlements on the grounds that smokers generate extra health care costs that must be borne by state governments. In other words, my taxes go to remove part of some smoker's lung. Private insurance companies do not have this problem. They simply recoup the extra cost of insuring smokers by charging them higher premiums. At the same time, smokers do provide a benefit to the rest of us. They die young. According to the American Lung Association, the average smoker dies 7 years earlier than the average non-smoker, which means that smokers pay into Social Security and private pension funds for all of their working lives, but then don't stick around very long to collect the benefits. Non-smokers, on average, get more back relative to what they paid in. The good folks at Philip Morris have even quantified this benefit for us. In 2001, they released a report on the Czech Republic, just as Parliament was considering raising cigarette taxes, showing that premature deaths from smoking saved the Czech government roughly $28 million a year in pension and old age housing benefits. The net benefit of smoking to the government, including taxes and subtracting public health costs, was reckoned to be $148 million. How does a market economy deal with externalities? Sometimes the government regulates the affected activity. The federal government issues thousands of pages of regulations every year on everything from groundwater contamination to poultry inspection. The states have their own regulatory structures. California, for example, has a strict set of emission standards for automobiles. Local governments have zoning laws that forbid private property owners from impinging on their neighbors by constructing buildings that may be unsafe, inappropriate for the neighborhood, or simply ugly. The island of Nantucket allows only a few select colors of exterior paint, lest irresponsible property owners use neon colors that would destroy the quaint character of the island. I live in a historic neighborhood in which every external change to our homes, from the color of new windows to the size of a flower box, must be approved by an architecture committee. There's another approach to dealing with externalities that tends to be favored in some cases by economists: taxing the offending behavior rather than banning it. I've conceded that my Ford Explorer was a menace to society. As Cornell economist Robert Frank noted in an op-ed for the New York Times, we are locked in an SUV arms race. Any family can only choose the size of its own vehicle. It cannot dictate what others buy. Any family that unilaterally bought a smaller vehicle might thus put itself at risk by unilaterally disarming, he wrote. Should the Hummer be banned? Should Detroit be ordered to manufacture safer, more fuel-efficient cars? Economists, including Mr. Frank, would argue not. The primary problem with SUVs, and all vehicles for that matter, is that they are too cheap to drive. The private cost of driving a Hummer to the grocery store is obviously far lower than the social cost. So raise the private cost. As Mr. Frank writes, the only practical remedy, given the undeniable fact that driving bulky, polluting vehicles causes damage to others, is to give ourselves an incentive to take this damage into account when deciding what vehicles to buy. If the real cost to society of having an Explorer on the road is 75 cents a mile instead of the 50 cents a mile that it costs the vehicle's owner to operate the vehicle, then tack on a tax that equates the two. This might be accomplished with a gas tax, or an emissions tax, or a weight tax, or some combination thereof. The result will make driving a Hummer to the grocery store a lot less attractive. But now we've entered strange terrain. Is it appropriate to allow some drivers to pay for the privilege of driving a vehicle so bulky that it might run over a Mini Cooper without even spilling the 64-ounce drink in the Monster cup holder? Yes, for the same reason that most of us eat ice cream even though it causes heart disease. We weigh the health costs of Starbucks almond fudge against that divine creamy taste and decide to have a pint every once in a while. We don't quit ice cream entirely, nor do we have it with every meal. Economics tells us that the environment requires the same kinds of trade-offs as everything else in life. We should raise the cost of driving an SUV, or any vehicle, to reflect its true social cost, and then let individual drivers decide if it still makes sense to commute 45 miles to work in a Chevy Tahoe. Taxing a behavior that generates a negative externality creates a lot of good incentives. First, it limits the behavior. If the cost of driving a Ford Explorer goes to 75 cents a mile, then there will be fewer explorers on the road. As important, those people who are still driving them and paying the full social freight will be those who value driving an SUV the most, perhaps because they actually haul things or drive off-road. Second, a gas guzzler tax raises revenue, which a ban on certain kinds of vehicles does not. That revenue might be used to pay for some of the costs of global warming, such as research into alternative energy sources, or at least building a dike around some of those Pacific Island nations. Or it might be used to reduce some other tax, such as the income or payroll tax, that discourages behavior we would rather encourage. Third, a tax that falls most heavily on hulking, fuel-hungry vehicles will encourage Detroit to build more fuel-efficient cars, albeit with a carrot rather than a stick. If Washington arbitrarily bans vehicles that get less than 18 miles per gallon without raising the cost of driving those vehicles, then Detroit will produce a lot of vehicles that get, no big surprise here, about 18 miles a gallon. Not 20, not 28, not 60, using new solar technology. On the other hand, if consumers are going to be stuck with a tax based on fuel consumption and or the mass of the vehicle, then they'll have very different preferences when they step into the showroom. The automakers will respond quickly, and other products like the Hummer will be sent where they belong, to some kind of museum for mutant industrial products. Is taxing externalities a perfect solution? No. Far from it. The auto example alone has a number of problems, the most obvious of which is getting the size of the tax right. Scientists are not yet in complete agreement on how quickly global warming is happening, let alone what the costs might be, or, many steps beyond that, what the real cost of driving a Hummer for a mile might be. Is the right tax 75 cents? $2.21? $3.07? You'll never get a group of scientists to agree on that, let alone the Congress of the United States. There's an equity problem, too. I've stipulated correctly that if we raise the cost of driving gas guzzlers, then those who value them most will continue to drive them. But our measure of how much we value something is how much we're willing to pay for it, and the rich can always pay more for something than everyone else. If the cost of driving an Explorer goes to $9 a gallon, then the people driving them might be hauling wine and cheese to beach parties on Nantucket, while a contractor in Chicago who needs a pickup truck to haul lumber and bricks can no longer afford it. Who really values their vehicle more? Clever politicians might get around the equity issue by using a tax on gas guzzlers to offset a tax that falls most heavily on the middle class, such as the payroll tax, in which case our Chicago contractor would pay more for his truck, but less to the IRS. And last, the process of finding and taxing externalities can get out of control. Every activity generates an externality at some level. Any thoughtful policy analyst knows that some individuals who wear spandex in public should be taxed, if not jailed. I live in Chicago, where hordes of pasty people, having spent the winter indoors on the couch, flock outside in skimpy clothing on the first day in which the temperature rises above 50 degrees. This can be a scary experience for those forced to witness it, and is certainly something that young children should never have to experience. Still, a tax on spandex is probably not practical. I've wandered from my original, more important point. Anyone who tells you that markets left to their own devices will always lead to socially beneficial outcomes is talking utter nonsense. Markets alone fail to make us better off when there is a large gap between the private cost of some activity and the social cost. Reasonable people can and should debate what the appropriate remedy might be. Often, it will involve government. Of course, sometimes it may not. The parties involved in an externality have an incentive to come to a private agreement on their own. This was the insight of Ronald Coase, a University of Chicago economist who won the Nobel Prize in 1991. If the circumstances are right, one party to an externality can pay the other party to change their behavior. When my neighbor Stuart started playing his bongos, I could have paid him to stop, or to take up a less annoying instrument. If my disutility from his noise is greater than his utility from playing, I could theoretically write him a check to put the bongos away and leave us both better off. Some contrived numbers will actually help to make the point. If Stuart gets $50 of utility from banging away, and I feel the noise does $100 an hour of damage to my psyche, then we're both better off if I write him a check for $75 to take up knitting. He gets cash that does him more good than the bongos. I pay for silence, which is worth more to me than the $75 it costs. But wait a minute. If Stuart is the guy making the noise, why should I have to pay him to stop? Maybe I don't. One of Coase's key insights is that private parties can only resolve an externality on their own if the relevant property rights are clearly defined, meaning that we know which party has the right to do what. As we'll explore later in the chapter, property rights often involve things far more complicated than just property. Does Stuart have the right to make whatever noise he wants? Or do I have the right to work in relative quiet? Presumably, the statutes for the city of Chicago answer that question. The answer may depend on time of day. Giving him the right to make noise up until some specified hour and giving me the right to silence during the nighttime hours. If I have the right to work in peace, then any payment would have to go the opposite direction. Stuart would have to pay me to start banging away. But he wouldn't do that in this case because it's not worth it to him. As a temperamental writer, the silence is worth $100 to me. So Stuart would have to pay me at least that much to endure the noise. Playing the bongos is only worth $50 to him. He's not going to write a check for $100 to do something that provides only $50 of utility. So I get my silence for free. This explains Coase's second important insight. The private parties will always come to the same efficient solution, the one that makes the best use of the resources involved, regardless of which party starts out with the property right. The only difference is who ends up paying whom. In this case, the disputed resource is our common wall and the sound waves that move back and forth across it. The most efficient use of that resource is to keep it quiet, since I value my peaceful writing more than Stuart values his bongo playing. If Stuart has the right to make noise, I'll pay him to stop, and I get to write in peace. If I have the right to silence, Stuart won't be willing to pay enough for me to accede to his bongos, and I get to write in peace. Remarkably, this kind of thing actually happens in real life. My favorite example is the Ohio Power Company that neighbors claimed was emitting a bizarre blue plume that was causing damage to property and health. The Clean Air Act gave the town's 221 residents the right to sue the utility to stop the pollution. So, the American Electric Power Company had a decision to make. 1. Stop polluting. Or 2. Pay the entire town to move somewhere else. The New York Times reported on the answer. Utility buys town it choked, lock, stock, and blue plume. The company paid the residents roughly 3 times what their houses were worth in exchange for a signed agreement never to sue for pollution-related damages. For $20 million, the utility's problems packed up and went away, literally. Presumably, this made financial sense. The New York Times reported that this settlement was believed to be the first deal by a company to dissolve an entire town. It will help the company avoid the considerable expense and public relations mess of individual lawsuits, legal and environmental experts said. Coase made one final point. The transaction's costs related to striking this kind of deal, everything from the time it takes to find everyone involved to the legal costs of making an agreement, must be reasonably low for the private parties to work out an externality on their own. Stuart and I can haggle over the fence in the backyard. The American Electric Power Company can manage to strike a deal with 221 homeowners. But private parties are not going to work out a challenge like CO2 emissions on their own. Every time I get into my car and turn on the engine, I make all of the 6 billion inhabitants of the planet slightly worse off. It takes a long time to write checks to 6 billion people, particularly when you're already late for work. And it's arguable that some people in cold climates will benefit from climate change, so maybe they should pay me. The property rights related to greenhouse gases are still ambiguous, too. Do I